Okay, so now we've talked about transcription, translation, regulation. We can look at mutation and repair in an intelligent fashion now that some of the terminology of mutation will make sense to you at this point. It wouldn't have a couple of weeks ago. But basically, mutations are inherited alterations in DNA sequence. We'll talk about some mutations that pop up you don't actually inherit, but you typically don't pass them along either. Okay. So mutation is the source of genetic variation. We tend to have this view, okay, mutation is necessarily a bad thing. It's not. Mutation is just change in DNA sequences. And many changes in DNA sequences are neutral. Some are, in fact, beneficial. A lot of them are detrimental. But a mutation is just a change in DNA sequence. And without mutation, there wouldn't have been evolution. But keep in mind, when we talk about evolution through natural selection, mutation is only the first part of that. Mutation is, in fact, the random process. But selection is anything but random. And so the environment in which the organism lives determines whether that mutation is beneficial or neutral or detrimental. Okay? The change in the base itself isn't a good, bad, or indifferent thing. It's how that affects the organism's abilities to survive in a competitive environment that determines whether it's a beneficial, detrimental, or neutral mutation. So some mutations are the source of disease or disorders. We'll talk about a few of those the rest of the way. We'll have one entire lecture on cancer. Cancer, you typically have to have two mutation events to occur before you get a serious cancer. And we'll talk about those at the time. But it is a useful way for scientists to probe how things work. Okay, we're going to drop the lecture on biotechnology. So I'll tell you a lame story to kind of get the point across how geneticists approach their job and how biochemists approach their job. Oftentimes they're trying to study the same thing, but they do so in completely opposite fashions. Geneticists break things to study them. Okay? Geneticists will look at mutants and see what they can't do to figure out what that gene normally did. So there's a story that was published in Genetics a long time ago, and it was about there are two retired scientists, and they live side by side. They live on top of a hill, and they would get together for coffee in the morning. They would get together for a beer in the afternoon. One of them was a retired geneticist. The other was a retired biochemist. And in the valley below where they lived was an auto manufacturing plant. Now, both of these guys, having been very studious scientists in their life, they never learned to drive. They never learned how cars worked. And one day as they were sitting up there drinking their beers in the afternoon, they decided, you know, we've got this free time now. Why don't we use our respective professional skills and try to figure out how cars are made and how cars function? And so they decided they would do it. So the next morning they go down, they go about their work, then they get together for beer in the afternoon, and they compare notes. And the biochemist says, well, I bought a bunch of cars, I broke them down to the component parts, and I now know that cars are 85% metal, 10% plastic, and 5% glass. So tomorrow I'm going to buy those raw materials and I'm going to try and reconstitute the system. Start doing that. The geneticist said, well, I went down, and as the workers were walking into the factory, I put one of them in handcuffs. And what I noticed is when the cars came out, they had front and rear windshields, but they didn't have windshields on the side or windows on the side. So I now know that that worker is responsible for installing side windows, and the installation of side wall windows is independent from the installation of front and rear windows. So the second day they did it, and the biochemist is getting frustrated because he's determined this is a very complex system and he needs to break it down to smaller parts before he could reconstitute the system. But he's still trying. He's determined that there are actually 17 different types of plastics in the car, and that the dominant metal is steel. And the geneticist said, well, he handcuffed another worker that day, and what he noticed is, as they left the factory, that instead of turning into the storage lot, they just kept going straight into the adjacent field. And he also noticed that they were missing that steering wheel thing in the front of the car. So he determined that that worker was responsible for the installation of those steering wheels, and they were involved in guidance of the cars, the ability to make at least a left-hand turn out of the factory into the storage lot. The third day, the biochemist had realized it's just way too expensive to try to reconstitute a car with the information that he had. The geneticist was really disappointed, too, because he said that instead of the first 2 days, he had handcuffed somebody carrying a lunchbox into the factory, so he thought they would have a very discreet function. The third day, he went hog wild, and he decided to handcuff somebody that was carrying a briefcase. He thought they might be some sort of global regulator that would the entire factory would shut down. But as far as he could tell, it had no function, no loss of function when he handcuffed that particular employee. So he would have to then determine the higher regulatory functions at a more discrete level. Okay, so it's a silly story. Everybody understands how a car works, but it actually tells you how geneticists go about their job. They break something, and then they look at the organism and see if they could distinguish what's not working anymore, and then they could tie it back. Okay, that thing that I broke must be involved in this process, and this process is independent from everything that's still working properly. And when you read papers or you see lectures about molecular genetics, that was what happened, that there were a lot of scientists that were breaking a lot of genes by inducing mutations and then looking at them to figure out what they did that was slightly different from unaltered bacteria. So in a molecular genetics lab, mutation is still a very useful tool. We disrupt genes to see what their role is in the overall biological function. Okay? All right, so some genes or some mutations can occur, if you just get exposed to UV light. Okay? I'll hammer away at that the next few weeks because it's one that at your age is the most common. It's a big problem. Particularly Australia is having a huge problem now with skin cancer among people in their 20s and 30s. But if it's just a matter of your somatic cells, the cells that make up your body, that's just a mutation you're going to have to struggle with. You're not going to pass it along to your offspring if you get a melanoma on your arm because you've spent too much time in a tanning bed or on the beach. Okay. But there are also germline mutations, and these are ones that occur in the germ cells, so the ones that will become the sperm or the egg, and those are passed to your offspring. Okay. So somatic mutations end with you. Germline mutations get passed along. And when we think in terms of evolution through natural selection, it's the germline mutations that are the ones that result in changes over time through evolution. Okay. And here's just an example of the difference between those two things. Here's a zebrafish, which again is a genetic model system. David Rubin in the School of Biological Sciences works with zebrafish. So this is one that you could actually, if you find them really compelling, you could do an undergraduate research project on zebrafish genetics. But here we've got somatic tissue. Here's their germline tissue. This is, as we know scientifically, called their naughty bits. And so if you get a somatic mutation in a cell, it could result in a change of pigmentation, and you get this mosaic spot. Any cell then that arises from that mutated cell will have that mutation. And as organisms, even when they stop developing, you still have that turnover of cells. You need to produce new cells to replace aging or damaged ones. So this organism would be mosaic, that some of its cells would carry the mutation, so you would get this sort of mosaic pattern of pigmentation, but that would not be passed along to the offspring. Okay. But if you get the same mutation, but it's in a germline, you could have the offspring having their entire pigmentation thrown off, but this organism itself, the one that had the mutation, since it wasn't in its somatic cells, you wouldn't see a manifestation of that change in pigmentation. Okay, so somatic stays with this one. Germline would be passed along, and this one could pass that same mutation along to its offspring. But in a competitive environment, if you're a zebrafish, you know, part of being able to pass the mutation along means that you've got to survive to the age of sexual reproduction, and you have to be successful in attracting a mate. Okay, we tend to focus on survival of the fittest. That's the little phrase that everybody uses when they think about mutation. It's not just survival of the fittest. It's you got to get it on with somebody if you are a sexually reproducing organism. All right. Very early we talked about that that's one of the costs of that is you have to attract and attract a mate and reproduce. So this change, this mutation and this change in pigmentation could potentially be bad on two fronts. Right? Zebrafish are striped for camouflage. And so now all of a sudden if you're striped but you're pink, you don't blend into a typical zebrafish environment that well. And, you know, you kind of need to find a lady zebrafish that likes pink males as opposed to the normal ones. But it may be more successful at attracting a mate. Okay, so there are two aspects of selection: surviving in the environment and then being successful at reproducing and passing that trait along. So it would have to play out if we just have these in an aquarium in David Rubin's lab. This mutation is neither beneficial nor detrimental. David Rubin is still going to feed the zebrafish in his tank. There's not a predator fish in there. That fish would probably have the same survival rate as all the others, but if we put them in their natural environment, the environment determines whether it's a beneficial or detrimental or a neutral mutation. And the environment includes competitors, predators, and potential mates. Okay, and I'm sure you guys covered all that in ecology by people that understand that much better than me. All right, so some typical types of mutations. Base substitutions. So in a base substitution, all we're doing is swapping. We're not adding or deleting any genetic information. We're just swapping a single nucleotide for one of a different base. You don't need to know transition, transversions. You'll read it in the literature where they refer to those. But basically, you can swap in the same class. You could swap a purine for a purine, an A for a G, or a pyrimidine for a pyrimidine. Typically, a more severe mutation would be when you're switching classes so that you swap a purine for a pyrimidine. Remember, you always have a purine hydrogen bonded to a pyrimidine in the double-stranded DNA molecule, so there are always three rings. When you start getting these transversions, then you're getting to a point where either you have two rings or four rings that are in there. Okay. Insertions and deletions, those can have a very serious effect, even if it's a single base. And we'll talk about frameshift mutations here in just a second. All right. So here's the original sequence. Okay, so we've got in this codon, we've got GTA. A base substitution would just be here, we're switching the T for a C. Okay. So now that you've, in your head and on paper now, you have kind of done transcription and translation, you understand the idea of a codon and reading frame, where the open reading frame of a gene gets broken down every three nucleotides is a codon that encodes for a particular amino acid. So here we've switched out this T with the C as a result of mutation. That changes the codon. Okay? If you change the codon, that means you will change, potentially change the amino acid for which it encodes. In this case, you would. Okay? Insertions. Now, after this T, we've inserted another nucleotide. And if you look, this causes what's referred to as a frameshift mutation. We had this original reading frame. with this frame, okay, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, if we add a base in there, we not only affect this codon, it's changed from GTA to GTT, but now every codon downstream is dramatically different. We've shifted our reading frame over one, so now we're not reading 1, 2, 3, we're reading 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1. It changes all of the amino acids downstream. So frame shifts are serious mutations unless they occur right at the very end of a gene. Okay? You can maybe swap the last few amino acids and still get function, but if you insert a nucleotide, you get a frame shift. Same thing if you delete that T that's in the middle of that codon we've been staring at. You not only change this codon, but you change the reading frame. So now we're all the codons downstream, instead of being 1, 2, 3, are now 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. So the insertion or deletion of anything that's not divisible by 3 evenly results in a frame shift. If you insert 3 nucleotides in there, you've messed up, say we just insert TTT. If you insert that, you've messed up this codon, you've messed up that, but after that, the reading frame continues. You've basically just added, you've messed up one amino acid, you've added an extra amino acid, and after that, it plays out the same. Same thing with the deletion. You've just removed one amino acid. You've altered one, potentially, depending on which part of the codon it's in. But after that, the rest of the protein is the same. You can have compensatory mutation. If we delete this T, but we insert another nucleotide just downstream of that, very close, you would have a small number of amino acids that would be affected, and then the reading frame would be restored again. Okay? But frame shifts tend to be among the most severe mutations. Okay, some other terminology, forward mutation. When we talk about mutations, the normal form of the organism or cell is referred to as the wild type. Wild type is non-mutated. So we, in labs, when we use those mutations to study, we're always comparing mutants to the wild type to look for changes in functions. So a forward mutation is when you get a mutation going from the wild type to a mutant form. Okay? So we've altered the function from what the normal condition was. You do get reverse mutations. And a reverse mutation is when you get a base change that takes an organism from the mutant type to the wild type. Sometimes these are referred to as reversion mutations, or in your book they use the term reverse mutation. It was a mutant. At some point in time in the lineage of that organism, that base had been changed from wild type to mutant, and now we see just the reverse mutation taking place. So you can restore wild type in a lineage with a reverse mutation. Okay. All right, so some ones that I really want you to know. We've got missense, and we'll talk about nonsense, and silent mutations. Okay, missense is when you change a codon and it results in a change of an amino acid at one position. Okay, so when we get with these, we're talking about base substitutions. Okay, we're not talking about frame shifts with these. We're just changing a single nucleotide, and we're looking at what possible effects that change of a single nucleotide could be. Missense, you change one amino acid. Okay, in the protein. So you've changed the codon on the DNA that encodes a particular amino acid. Now it encodes another amino acid. Okay. Silent mutation is you make a mutation, you alter a base, but it doesn't result in any change in the protein. We can see the change in the DNA, but the protein is exactly the same. And remember when we talked about that table of codon usage and amino acids, the idea of wobble, that many times you'll have four codons that will encode the same amino acid or at least two for everything but methionine. If you get a mutation in the third position of a codon, it frequently is a silent mutation. You change the nucleotide sequence, but you don't change the codon enough that it encodes for a different amino acid. And then nonsense are when you change from an amino acid to a stop codon. Okay. And this results in, we refer to this as truncation of the protein. Just means that the protein stops being expanded at that point, so you've got a shorter protein. Okay. And just like frame shifts, nonsense mutations are more severe the closer to the front of the gene that they are. If you just have a few amino acids after this change, okay, you could probably still get a somewhat functional protein. If it happens near the amino terminus of a protein as it's being assembled, then you're missing the bulk of the protein. It's not going to be functional. Okay, so there's a fair amount of variation in frame shifts and nonsense mutations, how severe they are. Okay, and then up here we've got neutral mutations. So these are missense mutations. They're not silent. Okay, a neutral mutation is not silent, but oftentimes what they'll do is encode it for another amino acid of similar properties. So if you've got a hydrophobic R group on an amino acid and it gets mutated and you still have a hydrophobic amino acid that's put in there, the protein will still take on a three-dimensional shape that's very similar. But all of a sudden if you swap out a hydrophobic amino acid for an acidic amino acid, that will affect the three-dimensional shape of the protein. So neutral mutations are typically you're swapping out like for like with respect to charge or hydropathicity of the amino acids. It doesn't alter the function, but it does change the amino acid sequence. Okay, this is just picture showing missense, nonsense, and silent mutations, what we just said. Okay. And then this is some terminology that goes along basically with the type of mutation. Loss of function, that's when you see a complete or partial loss of activity of the protein. You cannot have a silent mutation that results in a loss of function, just by definition. Same thing with neutral. So this is, loss of function would be limited to a frame shift, a missense, or a nonsense mutation. You can do gain of functions. When you're in a research lab and you induce mutation, you live for the days in which you see a gain of function mutation. That they're less common. It's much easier to break things than it is to come up with something that has a new function. But there are gain-of-function mutations. And that is, it can either be an entirely new function or it could be that a gene is expressed at different times or at different levels. So if you alter the regulatory region of a gene, you can see a gain of function where it's expressed at different times. The idea of starting out with really simple living things and over time coming up with organisms with very involved genomes, to some people it seems like there's not a valid mechanism that's in place. If you work in a research lab and you do mutations, you run across gain-of-function mutations. And so if you couple that with the idea of duplication events, so you now have two copies of a gene, one of which can be mutated without causing any damage to the original function, the combination of duplication and mutation is a very valid mechanism to explain genomes getting larger in eukaryotes. Okay. And then there's conditional mutation. So there are some mutations that you change the bases and they function normally, but then if you put them under a certain condition, you can see a difference. And the most common is temperature-sensitive mutations. Remember, proteins take on a certain three-dimensional shape under certain conditions. If you change one or more amino acids, maybe the protein will stick together in that shape under, at room temperature conditions, but if you start bumping it up, then that three-dimensional shape isn't maintained as well in the mutant as it is the wild type, and it starts to take on an altered form and doesn't function as well. Quite a few experiments are done with temperature-sensitive mutants in Drosophila, in fruit flies. Okay. Lethal mutation, the name tells you this is severe enough that it causes death of the organism in which the mutation occurs. And single-cell organisms like bacteria, that it's pretty easy to get a lethal mutation. Something like if you alter the DNA polymerase or the RNA polymerase, the genes that encode those, the organism can't function at that point. It can't replicate or it can't transcribe its genes. So some essential process, once a component of it has been knocked out, it results in lethality. There are suppressor mutations, and that is a mutation that hides the effect of another. So these are a little bit tougher to understand. One of the best classes of suppressor mutations are if you have... if you've got a nonsense mutation, so you've got termination that's happening early in a very important protein, you can have a mutation in the tRNA for that amino acid. So we switch from an amino acid, say that it was alanine. We switch from alanine to stop in a very important gene. If you have another mutation in which the tRNA molecule for alanine has been mutated, and now something that would normally be a stop codon is present on the anticodon of an alanine tRNA molecule. You would come up to something that should be a stop, but now a tRNA molecule is bringing an alanine in. It would suppress this mutation. Okay, that organism would have other problems, but that would be technically be a suppressor mutation. It would hide the effects of the original one. Suppressor mutations are not reversions. It doesn't count if you just go back and undo the change. That's reversion. This is a mutation at another position that hides that effect. Okay. And then we've got intragenic. So that's a mutation that takes place in the same gene for a suppressor. Intergenic is one that takes place in a different gene. And as I mentioned, these are most commonly tRNA genes in which that takes place. Okay. So here's the mutation rate of different organisms. So the mutation rate varies for different genes. And so this is, if you look, so we'll look at E. coli. Lac fermentation has about 2 times 10 to the minus 7th. And that's cell divisions. So if you're looking at any particular gene, you've got to have a large number of cell divisions before it becomes likely that there will be a mutation in that individual gene. If you look down here at humans, you actually have slightly more, a higher rate of mutation than bacteria do. But you've got a larger number of genes that are in your genome as well, so the overall mutational load is lower. But one of the more common ones that pops up is Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's a X-linked gene. It's involved in, so it's the most, one of the most common forms of muscular dystrophy. It affects males much more often than females. And oftentimes, women are carriers for Duchenne, and they're aware of the fact that they're a carrier. They go through genetic counseling. They're told that if they have sons, that they're 50% chance that their sons will have muscular dystrophy. But it's also one of the genes that you see de novo mutations the most often. The dystrophin gene is huge, and so the more area it covers, the more likely it is to pick up mutations. It's a woman, I want to say she was in Michigan, and she had identical twins. And later in life, they were found that they had Duchenne, and the doctor that diagnosed them assumed that she was aware of the fact that she was a carrier, and he just started reaming her out about, you know, how could you do that to the kids? And meanwhile, her sons are right in the room with her, and he's talking about how, you know, she has condemned them to this poor quality of life, and she was irresponsible, and so that guy got his ass sued to the back to the dark ages because she had a de novo case that they went back and looked, and she was not a carrier. Her somatic cell line was not a carrier. She had a de novo mutation in her germ cell line that caused it. Even if they had done genetic counseling, they take blood samples. They don't look at eggs, they wouldn't have caught it. But there's this tendency to think about that disease being a familial disease, but a significant number of cases are de novo mutations. Okay. Some mutations, so now we're going to start talking about the causes. You've gotten all these terms, different types of mutations, how they play out in the organism. Now we're going to talk about how some of the mechanisms by which mutation takes place. And some of them are just caused by screw-ups in replication. You've got an existing strand, and you're going to try to make the complementary strand. And so here we've separated the wild-type DNA into the two strands. This one we replicate perfectly. This one, there's a altered replication. The polymerase grabbed the wrong nucleotide, and it didn't catch it. And it caught the wrong one, so it introduced the wrong one. And then when this organism replicates, it will have half of its lineage will be wild type, and half, both strands, will be mutant. For one generation, you get this situation called a wobble. Sorry, we recycled an old phrase, in which those bases won't pair perfectly, right? You've got a T across from a G. They're not complementary base pairs. So for one generation, you've got a mismatch. After that, assuming replication goes well, you'll have one strand that will replicate a wild type. The other strand will perpetuate that mutation. Okay? So that's how you get perpetuations of mutations. If you don't catch it in this generation where it's mismatched, it will just be assumed that that's the normal wild-type sequence, and DNA polymerase will find the complement to that during the next round of replication and will perpetuate that mutation. Okay. So it's important in terms of the cell if you could catch this mutation in this generation when it's mismatched. Okay. There's another type of error that you can get. It's called strand slippage. Okay, and in strand slippage, what generally happens is you've got a run of the same base. So either a lot of A's or a lot of T's or a lot of C's. There's a long run of the same nucleotide. And what can happen is you just get a loop that forms in the newly synthesized strand, but the ones around it will still base pair, right? If each one of these positions was unique, this wouldn't happen. But the fact that we're in a long run of A's or T's or C's of the same thing, the ones around it will still bind and clamp it down. And you go along, and now we've got an insertion event. So that's one of the ways that you can get an insertion. Here we get one that is looped out on the template strand, and that would result in a deletion eventually. Okay, so insertion and deletion events can happen as a result of strand slippage. You normally see those in regions where you have long runs of the same nucleotide, and it's just a loop forms and the polymerase just keeps going. Okay. When we talked about recombination and chromosomal swapping of information, you can get unequal crossing over, so non-reciprocal crossing over. And so you can get the introduction of additional sequences to one chromosome that would be coupled by the deletion on the other. So unequal crossing over within an open reading frame on a gene is a bad thing, because at that point, one lineage will have an insertion deletion, the other lineage will have a deletion mutation from those chromatids. Right, so those are ones that are a result of natural biological processes, that things just happen. Okay, during replication or during cell division. But mutation is also affected by the environment. Okay, so you can be exposed to certain chemicals that can carry out specific mutations. One of them is called depurination. And that is, you lose a purine. So the base of a purine is actually removed from these. There's another, it's actually more common, deamination, where an amino group is lost from the base. So some of the bases have amino groups that are present on them. Deamination, they just lose the amino group. That affects which base they will make, will be viewed as their complement. So here's an example of depurination. We've got this sequence. The base is lost. Okay, keep in mind, we're not talking about the entire nucleotide. When we're talking about deletions, the entire nucleotide was gone. With depurination, the nucleotide backbone is still there. We still have the deoxyribose and the phosphate are still taking up the same amount of space, but now there's no base coming off of carbon 1. So you basically get this gap that takes place. It's called an apurinic site, but there's the backbone there. There's just no base sticking out into space to make hydrogen bonds with the complement. And what will happen with these during replication, the strands will be separated, and typically what will happen is if it's not repaired back here, once the strands separate, the replication mechanism goes to A by default. And we've guessed wrong. We had a 1 in 4 chance of it actually being an A. It's not. And now this entire lineage will be mutant. Okay. And so that's altered from the wild type. So again, it's in the organism's best interest to catch a mutation and correct it before the next round of replication, because a mutation can be perpetuated from that point on. This is just an example of deamination. If you've got cytosine and it's deaminated, it becomes uracil. Talked about how uracil is present in RNA. Uracil is present in DNA, but it's an indicator of damage, DNA damage. So you've got specific DNA repair mechanisms that scan for uracil in DNA because it results from deamination. Okay. So there's an entire field of genetics. And in fact, ISU used to be one of the places in which this research was carried on at the highest level, that there used to be three geneticists at ISU that studied the mutagenic effects of certain chemicals. And if you had Dr. Katz for 197, when Alan was an active researcher, that was one of the things that he did, is he studied the rates of mutagenesis associated with certain compounds. So there's this, I forget what the professional society is called. Eric Larson is in that professional society now, and when he goes, people find out he's at ISU, they're really wowed by it, that it's like four of the last six presidents of that professional society were students at ISU at one point in time or another. But Katz doesn't do research anymore. The other people retired. So if you're interested in this, we've got a lot of the old books in the library, but nobody does that in their lab that much anymore. And that is, you can do specific tests to look at how likely a particular substance is to induce mutations. And a compound that does is referred to as a mutagen. Gen here being short for genesis, the creation of or start of. So a compound that creates a mutant mutation is called a mutagen. Something that causes birth defects is called a teratogen. So most teratogens are mutagens, but if you ever look at warnings on chemical labels, they will tell you if something is a mutagen or a teratogen. So what happens, there are a lot of specific mechanisms that can result in chemicals affecting your DNA. Here's just an example of one of them, that you can have a thymine that gets modified at this position from a substance containing a bromide, and it substitutes out, and then you get a different nucleotide that behaves differently. Okay? So it comes down to the fact that you make a chemical change in a base, and that base no longer pairs the way that it did before. And this is just showing that now instead of that by normal pairing, you would have had an adenine across from it, but if that's not repaired when it's ionized, then you would get a guanine that would form base pairs with it. So the next round of replication would induce this mutation of a guanine on the opposite strand. And this is just showing how that affects the lineages. Just a couple of chemicals. EMS is highly mutagenic. EMS is actually what we use in the lab to chemically induce mutations. We can take cell lines, do a fairly dilute solution of EMS, and with a bacterial system, if we've got about 500 mils of bacterial culture, if I put 5 microliters of EMS in, I've got pretty good assurance that about 1 out of every 5 bacteria will have a mutation in them at that point. And most have multiple mutations. Mustard gas was actually a mutagen. So on top of doing bad things at the physiological level, mustard gas is one of the top 5 mutagenic agents that has been discovered so far. Oxidative reaction. Okay, this is one that occurs naturally. That whenever you have reactive oxygen and hydrogen molecules around, they cause damage to protein and nucleic acids. Okay, when you carry out cellular respiration, you produce reactive oxygen and hydrogen molecules. And so it's just a natural part of trying to extract energy from your environment, and over time you accumulate damage to your DNA. Okay. Your cells have pretty good defenses against those. You produce a molecule called superoxide dismutase, which combines reactive oxygen, reactive hydrogen. It produces hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is not good for you. If you took 197 here, one of the first experiments that you did was use an enzyme called catalase to break down hydrogen peroxide into oxygen and water, and that's what happens. Inside of your cell, you produce catalase that converts the hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. Hydrogen peroxide will damage your cells just as well as it does microbial cells. There are at least a dozen toothpastes on the market right now that have hydrogen peroxide in them. And there are really nice studies that show that long-term usage of those toothpastes, your teeth may be really white, but you're dramatically increase the rate of periodontal disease because that erodes your gum tissue away by reoccurring exposure to hydrogen peroxide. If you use hydrogen peroxide occasionally, if you've got a cold sore or something that you want to deal with, but you shouldn't be gargling with hydrogen peroxide or brushing with it on a daily basis. It's detrimental to your tissue as well. And so one of the ways, too, that you can deal with reactive oxygens, that there are vitamins and nutrients that you can have that deal with the reactive oxygen and hydrogen radicals. They're called antioxidants. So as a rule of thumb, fruits and vegetables that have bright colors in the orange, red, and purple family. I need you guys to quit whispering, okay? I can hear you all the way up here. All right, so if food's got, you know, purple or an orange color, those pigments are oftentimes caused by molecules that look a lot like cytochromes. If you remember way back in cellular respiration, cytochromes are molecules that accept and hand off electrons as they move through. So molecules that are pigmented are very good at helping cells to scour reactive molecules and atoms around. So eat your orange and purple fruits and vegetables and you decrease the likelihood of DNA damage by superoxide radicals. Remember, cancers are caused by typically two mutations. Sometimes those mutations are just a result of your day-in, day-out metabolic activity. And so you do, in fact, decrease the risk of certain cancers by eating carrots and eggplant and purple cabbage. Intercalating agents. Intercalating agents are used in labs all the time because they're really good to allow us to stain nucleic acids. If you're in 220 lab this semester, if you've had it, or if you're going to take biotech, or if you're in a research lab, whenever you run DNA down an agarose gel, you add ethidium bromide. And ethidium bromide intercalates. It's a very flat, planar molecule, and it gets in between the bases of DNA. It slides in between the strands, and it allows us then to see the nucleic acid under UV light. The problem is that same ability to intercalate or slide in between the bases can induce mutations. So if you work with ethidium bromide, we have to dispose of it entirely separately than all of our other waste in the lab. People used to freak out about ethidium bromide, but newer studies that show its mutagenic property, if you dip your hand in ethidium bromide and shake it off, that's about the same mutagenic property as smoking a pack of cigarettes. So if you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, then you shouldn't be freaked out by coming into contact with a microliter or two of ethidium bromide in the lab. These are just showing the specific molecular mechanisms. Don't learn these. Okay. This is just showing how intercalating agents slide in and they adjust the or affect the spacing of the DNA. Radiation, that's a big one, especially if you live in the Marvel Universe, apparently. And so one of the things that happens is the most common, if you get two thymines that are side by side, if you irradiate that DNA, they will make a covalent bond and become what's referred to as a thymine dimer. We don't have a picture of that? Okay. So what will happen is, two of them side by side, they'll make a covalent bond, and it will interfere with their ability to form base pairs. But you've got this system that's present in bacteria. There's some evidence now that it's present at a lower level in eukaryotes, but it's called the SOS system. And if you hit bacteria with radiation or with a chemical mutagen, that they've got the ability to go in and undo that damage at a higher rate, but the SOS system in bacteria requires sunlight. You've got to give them full spectrum light and then they can do it. So there's actually pretty good evidence in humans that sunlight decreases the rate of mutation. If you get the proper exposure, if you get the right level of activity, but it's a combination of factors, one of which is we're now starting to appreciate how important vitamin D is in preventing mutation and preventing cancers. Right. Most of you guys get your vitamin D from milk or food sources, but for most of human history, we got the bulk of our vitamin D by hanging out in the sun. And you synthesize vitamin D with exposure to sunshine. So here's the best example that I can tell you about how important vitamin D and getting sunshine is. Okay? Caucasians are light-skinned because we don't need melanin to protect us. Melanin is essentially a molecular sunscreen that protects you from damage to UV irradiation. Okay? So when humans all lived in the equatorial region, we were seeing really strong sunlight. We needed protection from that. We needed melanin. As humans migrated away from the tropical range into the more temperate range, total sunlight decreased. Okay. Still get UV irradiation. Okay, we're at risk for UV irradiation. But melanin also, in addition to protecting us from UV from damage by UV irradiation, melanin also prevents production of vitamin D at lower sunlight levels. Okay. So one of the evolutionary changes that happened in humans as they migrated away from the tropics is there was a selection for the production of less melanin so that we could produce more vitamin D if we lived in a part of the planet that got less intense sunlight. And we were willing to trade off biologically greater protection against UV damage just so we can make vitamin D. Okay? I mean, that's a significant trade-off because, I mean, you see now people that work out in the sun, farmers, lifeguards, if they don't protect themselves with sunscreen, they're at risk for cancer. So, but biologically, making vitamin D is beneficial or there wouldn't have been that evolutionary trend towards fairer skin in regions of the world in which there was less direct sunlight. And they're starting to go back and look at studies that, so a shortage of vitamin D is associated with a disease called rickets. And when people of African descent were moving to or being moved to parts of the world in which there wasn't as much sunlight, rickets was a huge problem in people of African descent or dark pigmented people when they first move to areas where there's not as much sunlight if they don't supplement with vitamin D. So it's this balancing act that happened over a long period of time in evolution. So you do have a light-based mechanism for protecting yourself against mutation, but it's a more complicated system than the ones that bacteria have. So right now the recommendation is 25 to 45 minutes of full sunlight on your face. Most of the receptors that kick this system in are based on either your eyes or your face. And so you don't have to strip down in the middle of January. If you get on an open area, kick back, recline a little bit, get your face up to the sun for 25, 45 minutes, you get most of the positive effect that you need. You can synthesize most of the vitamin D that you need. People that have SAD, the seasonal affective disorder in the wintertime, the best treatment so far suggests their supplementation with vitamin D, that they're not getting out, not getting enough sunshine, so vitamin D supplementation. Most of the work now showing really positive effects. People with fibromyalgia are D-impaired, so either getting more sunlight or taking supplements of vitamin D has been clinically shown clinical significance. So the repair mechanism is there. If you're not getting enough D, your systems start to break down, so sunshine's a good thing. Yep.
Is skin cancer something that would happen over like one summer, or is it long term? We have to expose after again and again.
No, so it's a combination of frequency and magnitude, and then also your level of protection. So my son is the color of a sheet of typing paper or printer paper. I have the paciest child in the world. His mother is half Norwegian, half Swedish, and blonde, and my son is invisible if I hold him up here. But my daughter has my pigmentation. My family's actually Mediterranean, and so if I get out in the sun, I tan up really well. My daughter got my pigmentation. My son got his mother's pigmentation. And as a result, the two of them can get the same exposure to sunlight, and Andrew will always be at greater risk of skin cancer than Madeline, because melanin protects, and so he's got next to no protection. I mean, his cheeks will turn a little tannish in the summer at the end of baseball season. So he just gets, we slather him up with sunscreen 1 million or whatever. So part of it is your level. If you've got an area, once you tan, then you've got a little bit more defense. So if that idea of a base tan actually does play out, just don't go to Ultimate Tan and turn yourself into a Thanksgiving turkey, you know, in 3 days. But if you work up a base tan, you've got more protection. So if you go out the first day of, you know, spring break at Cancun and you're a pasty individual and you lay out for 6 hours and get a bad burn, you can get skin cancer from a single really bad episode. If you're more darker complected and you already have a tan and you go out to Cancun and you hang out 6 hours, you may not get anything from it. So it's so individually variable, so variable based on the intensity of the sun any one day. With most people, you can get the mutation, but it's not going to go anywhere without a second mutation. So you could get the rapid cell growth, but you're not going to have a problem unless you get a second mutation in the cell adherence and it starts spreading. But you can get a benign cancer with a single mutation. A malignant cancer requires two mutations. So, you just kind of have to judge how much sun you want to get based on your own risk factors. The paler complected you are, the greater risk you are at of skin cancer. Also, people with paler complexions are at greater risk of eye problems as a result of exposure to the sun. So if you're putting on sunscreen, you want to think about putting on the Oakleys as well, or whatever sunglasses you want to wear. My son's not going to be the coolest kid in summer vacation ever in his life. He's going to have zinc oxide on his nose and big old sunglasses and a big floppy hat probably. But all right, the Ames test. The Ames test is the protocol that they use to determine the mutagenic properties of certain compounds. So what they do is they've got a series of mutant strains of Salmonella typhimurium. they expose them to different agents, and then they look for the rate of reversion, mutation. And if you know the rate of reversion mutation, then you can calculate the overall mutagenic properties of that agent. So Ames is just a way that you stick the bacteria or you expose them to a chemical, look for reversion mutations, and calculate it. So Alan Katz, when he was an active researcher, did Ames tests all the time. Actually, Dr. Katz's claim to fame was he developed a slightly variant version of the Ames test that most people started using Alan's version instead of the original. Those of you who don't know, Alan Katz is arguably one of the 10 coolest guys on the planet. So, and he's got that killer mustache. So, yeah, his last name's Katz. So he's got that going for him, too. Let's see, that's just showing how the Ames tests go. Let's go into DNA repair mechanisms. All right, DNA repair mechanisms, I want you to know mismatch. And we'll talk a little bit about base excision and nucleotide excision. But mismatch is the one that's done if you've got mistakes in replication. The others you see more for damaged DNA. So here we've got DNA that's being synthesized. We've got the old template strand. This is the new strand that's being synthesized, and there's a mistake that's made. And remember, when I was playing the part of DNA polymerase, oftentimes if I just introduced the wrong one, 99.9% of the times, if I introduced the wrong one, I would take a step back, remove that, correct it, and move on. But out of those mistakes that I make as I'm trying to be fast, I miss one out of 1,000, and they're left behind. But following closely behind me is a mismatch repair mechanism that can figure out this change. You know, that we've got a mismatch. I've been stressing, okay, if you've got a change, you would have either four rings or two rings. Where normally there'd be three rings. Well, if we're just substituting a pyrimidine for a pyrimidine, we've not changed the number of rings in between there, but since they don't base pair, they're not spaced right. So when you've got mismatches between two strands, they don't maintain the same width apart. The strands either pinch or they bulge. And so basically what happens is there's this mismatch repair mechanism that goes along and it feels for changes in the width of the two strands. And when there's a variation, it knows that there's something wrong there. And so here we get it. We've got this bulge that's taking place here, and we want to correct that. Okay. Now, we've made the new strand of DNA. We've got a double-stranded molecule. You've got two bases, and they're not right. Which one do you replace? Okay. You assume the old one was right, so you want to replace the new one. But mechanistically, if you've got two strands of DNA and you're an enzyme, how do you know which one was the old one, which one was the new one? Okay, because if you grab the wrong one, you've just perpetuated a mutation. So you want to make sure that you're doing it on the new strand. So what happens is with DNA, your DNA is typically methylated. Frequently across the length of the strand, that it's methylated at particular base sequences. And when new DNA is synthesized, that methylation doesn't happen for a few minutes. So you've got a window of time in which the old strand is methylated, the new strand is not methylated, and the mismatch repair can distinguish the difference between the old and the new strand. And so it will come in and replace the nucleotide. What happens is it cuts out this whole region. It makes a loop. Part of it binds to the bulge. Part of it binds to the methylated old strand, the next methyl group that it sees. It forms this hairpin loop, and it chews up the unmethylated strand between those two points. So see, we've just gone in, started at this nucleotide, chewed it all the way back, And then a DNA polymerase comes in and synthesizes that whole region again. Ligase comes in and connects it. So it's not a single base that's just popped out and replaced, but that bulge identifies one of the boundaries of this region that will be replaced. Okay, so that's mismatch repair. But just think in terms of the mismatch repair mechanism sliding along the DNA, just feeling, and everything's constant, and all of a sudden it either sort of gets a pinch or it gets a bulge in the strands, and it just latches on there, waits on one of the methyl-binding proteins to interact with it, and then the process takes place. If you take 350 with Larson, he's a DNA repair guy, so you'll have about 3 hours of your life on this process, and you'll understand it much better, as Eric understands it much better than do I. Base excision is another way that mismatch repair is done, and in this one, this takes place after replication, and in this case, only a single base is popped out. And generally what happens is it's linked to glycosylase activity. You just pull out a single base, and a polymerase comes in and replaces it. Okay, but that would be a repair after DNA damage has caused a mismatch. Okay, so that no longer do you get the good complementation. We're not going to go into that one. Wow, that had a lot of pictures. This is an example of a genetic disease that's linked to faulty DNA repair. It's xeroderma pigmentosum, and this is an extreme example of kind of exposure to the UV radiation of sunlight, that they just don't have the ability to repair things like thymine dimers very efficiently. And so, you know, it kind of looks like freckles, but it's serious damage that's done to their skin and the DNA. So if you didn't have DNA repair mechanisms and you like to get outside in the summer, this is what your skin would look like if you were a pale-complected person. So the fact that, you know, the vast majority of us with pale skin don't look anything at all like this suggests that our DNA repair mechanism does an exquisite job of damaging or repairing the damaged DNA. And if you look here, this part of the neck, it doesn't get much exposure, and so it doesn't have very many of these spots. So these spots are correlated to DNA damage caused by UV irradiation. Let's see. And that's all I got for you. So understand the different terminologies, the types of mutations, what can cause a frame shift. But on DNA repair, I want you to understand the mismatch repair mechanism following replication in terms of a mechanism.